Hidden Gems, episode 51. So hidden, it's unranked. Welcome to Hidden Gems, a board game podcast where we review unusual, forgotten, and underappreciated board games. We're your hosts. My name is Chris.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Bill.
Thanks for listening to our show. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Jason.
No, you're fine.
I'm just glad you're here.
I'm sitting in Cameron's seat, so I feel like I have to take over his role. I normally do that.
Like I said, I'm just glad you're here, man. I know you've had one doozy of a month. Need you bring your energy up.
Yeah, I need something, man.
Yeah, I'm sitting here feeling stressed just looking at Jason, by the way.
Jason did his typical, every time he enters the game room, like clockwork, whether you realize it or not, Jason opens the door. He closes the door and then he sighs. This particular time, he sighed very heavily. So I know he's got a lot on him right now.
He's a double sigh today. Yeah, no, it's been a month and a half for sure with house moving. Anyone who has moved knows that it's challenging doing it with three kids. Makes it more challenging doing it in the midst of a million other things going on. Makes it extra challenging. And then we found out that our, did I talk about this last time? I might have. Who knows? Who remembers at this point? I can't remember what day it is. I've ripped apart our kitchen and am slowly putting it back together. Hopefully this weekend is the end of that. And we will have a fully functional kitchen for the first time since moving in. Had some water issues that we had to get taken care of. I'm reasonably handy, so I like to take that stuff on myself. It just takes longer and stresses me out.
So,
yeah.
So basically what we're saying is the reason this episode is a week late is Jason's fault. Pretty much.
I can own that.
I mean, let's just be honest. It's your fault.
Okay. It was my fault last time. It can be my fault this time.
I don't know, Chris. You had something going on in your life that time.
That is true.
Pretty much had a big impact on
To be fair, both of y'all were gone. So
I could have made it work. But yeah, I know you got a lot going on. I took the tour of your house. I got the walkthrough, and your house looks very hoarder-ish right now.
Yeah, we were getting new carpet, which is where all the kids' rooms are. And so you can't move anything anywhere until the carpet comes in. That happened today. We're good now.
That's true. I was there too, and I was expecting an HGTV guest to come in and say, okay, Jason, we need to work with you here on the...
This is like home rescue.
Yeah. This weekend, it's happening. So,
anything else been going on with you? Anything interesting?
Besides the house stuff?
So, I guess one minor update I guess I can throw out there. So after we did our big top 10 list video game thing on episode 50, I was writing down a couple of titles as we were going along of different games that I was like, oh yeah, I really should have played that by now.
Mm-hmm.
And Nintendo was doing a sale, as they do on a regular basis, on the eShop, and so I downloaded Portal.
Oh yeah,
like the companion edition. So it's Portal and Portal 2.
Awesome.
So I played all the way through Portal 1 in like 2 or 3 days. It's pretty short.
Yeah,
but thoroughly enjoyed that.
It is good.
Cool. It is good.
I'm excited to try Portal 2. I got my oldest son hooked on it now. So he's figuring it out. He's figuring out the double joystick thing for the first time.
He
doesn't play games like that.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
Nice. Filling in the holes.
That's awesome. So I started playing Alex again. And as I'm playing it, since I said it was like my favorite game ever, I absolutely want to get you guys over to the house to play through like at least the first hour to see what a really good game looks like. So
it's funny you should mention that. So I actually got a message today. I'll give them a little shout out just for funsies on Instagram. So Brian and Christina, they are of Tabletop Time. They post some stuff on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
We're like super interested in your games, Bill,
and
specifically
really?
Your VR games, which is shocking because I thought nobody would find any of your stuff interesting. But you're like, yeah, you know what type of VR Bill uses or something like that. What was his question? It was like, what did he say? What kind of VR setup does Bill have? So,
wow. Okay, so it started with an Oculus Quest 1, and that wasn't good enough. I had that for a few years. It was pretty awesome, and I have it set up to use it with the computer, so you would call that an Oculus Rift sort of emulator. Oculus Rift was an earlier version of one of Oculus's headset that only worked with a computer. But when they came out with the Oculus Quest, it had enough horsepower within the headset itself that it didn't require a computer anymore. So the graphics weren't necessarily as good, but you were no longer tethered.
Right.
And it was much cheaper, right? So you could buy that. It had a lot of cool stuff. However, when you're running your computer and you buy like a really nice NVIDIA graphics card or whatever, it opens up a whole new world.
You're immersed, I bet.
You're absolutely. And I've been playing Alex the last couple days, Half-Life Alex, which is the people that made Portal. It is as amazing as I remembered. It is absolutely just jaw-dropping. Yeah, you guys have to come over and play. So.
Dude, I have to admit, I am intrigued. When you described it, you hooked me a little bit. Just the whole idea of navigating through this town and trying not to get captured or killed, I guess. Sounds pretty terrifying at times.
It is, and they're such good storytellers. The acting in it is so good, and just the attention to detail. I can't oversell it, because once you look at it, you'll go, oh, God, yeah, Bill. The attention to detail on this is just nuts.
Yeah.
It's just nuts.
Hmm. That's awesome. Cool. Well, there you go. Brian answered your question for you.
Yeah. Awesome.
What has been going on with you, Bill, aside from
We were talking about this before we started, and I'm coming back to, I think I said this last time, my daughter's living in D.C., and that's giving us an opportunity to go up and visit quite a lot. And for, was it Christmas? Maybe it was for Father's Day. I don't know. They gave me tickets to go see Hadestown at the National Theater, which turned out to be awesome. And I was going to talk about that, but I'm not. But it's super highly recommended.
You can't build it up like that.
Oh, I could go on if you'd like, Chris.
How long is this going to be?
No, this is going to be super short.
The history of Hades?
No. But we what's kind of fun is
started back in 1973.
I was 20 at the time. It had a profound impact on my life.
I know. It helps you separate the different philosophies of materialism and capitalism. And so when you get into what Hadestown actually is, no, I'm not going to do this at all. What's kind of cool is going back to Washington in multiple iterations is you can start seeing some of the sites that you don't generally have time for if you're going for a weekend, right? And so this last time we went to the World War One Museum, Roosevelt Island, and Mount Vernon. And what I wanted to call out, talk a little bit, was about Mount Vernon.
I have plans to go there this year, I hope.
Oh, okay.
I've never been. I want to see it.
Yeah,
so I'm
yeah.
intrigued what you thought.
Well, it's super cool. They've learned a lot about what it looked like, and some of it was just kind of fascinating to get a glimpse into what they were guessing at versus now what they know, mm-hmm. as far as like how the outside looked and stuff like that, and or setting it up so it's just a good experience for people who show up. And what's one cool thing is about it is you don't really have like a tour guide. They have a person in every room that you go in that talks to you when you come into the room. And it was kind of an interesting way to do it. But anyway, it's just a very cool place to go. The thing I thought was really cool was when I went to the museum afterwards and we're walking around and they have different kids things you can do. Well, they've come up with this video game, What Would You Do If You're George Washington? And it's a website that you can look at when you're home. So if you have a party or something and you just go to Mount Vernon, George Washington, and there's four different scenarios. And it's like,
do you cut down the cherry tree or do you not?
It's based on his battles. And they have actors that come up and talk to you about what information that George had on in any one of these battles, and then you can pick from his advisors and they will give you advice on what you should do.
So it's like an interactive game.
It is an interactive game.
This is in person or
no, you can log into it on your
it's virtual. It's a virtual game. Okay.
So at the museum you can have a group of kids that could sit down and you all can play the same scenario on different ones and you all make different things. So if you all have a laptop at home, it's almost like a board game. You can play with each other and you each pick your own advisor. And then you can see who does the best.
Right.
Who wins the war. But anyway, it was very cool.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
That's so interesting.
It's like a little fun party game if you have three or four of you and you each have like a, you know, tablet or laptop or something. Probably your phone would work.
Fascinating.
Complete opposite end of that spectrum. I was poking around BGG today, which I haven't done in a surprisingly long time. And I noticed the American President. Have you seen this? It's like top on the hotness.
The new game. Yeah, I've seen it. It's like a table
epically,
hog.
Epically huge. What's the name of the publisher that makes them?
GMT.
Yeah. GMT game. Where it simulates the past 20 years of the U.S. presidency.
Oh, wow.
Like in a solo, solitaire.
You should see it. It would take up this whole game table.
Really?
Yes, it's huge.
I'm like, I know myself at this point and know that those types of games just don't work for me anymore, but I'm moderately intrigued.
Yeah, I'm moderately intrigued to know the person that would buy it because, you know, how does their brains work? Because that's, yeah.
I've seen it on Instagram quite a bit, actually.
Wow.
A lot of people are playing it.
That's pretty wild.
Intrigued.
Yeah. How about you, Chris?
Oh, man.
Saving the best for last.
Thank you so much. Well, it's not everybody that can say they're the father of a North American champion, but...
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, no, right. In all seriousness, I'm having a proud parent moment. So I've talked about it many times on here. All my kids are gamers in some respect, but my oldest son, Bryce, plays Valorant at a pretty high level, at a very competitive level.
I would say a really high level.
A really high level, yeah. Right. And so he's still under 18. So he's not on any like professional teams yet, although I wonder if maybe that's not where his life is going. But at any rate, he is in a league called XP League, which is basically a league that organizes PC gaming across the North American continent. And when I say that, I'm serious. We have teams from Canada at the North American Finals where we just were last week in Orlando. There was a team from Saskatchewan and there's a team from Ottawa that was represented there. So they play five different games, but the one that Bryce plays is Valorant. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a variation on Counter-Strike, if you're familiar with Counter-Strike. It's basically mm-hmm. Counter-Strike with special powers.
Right.
And so his team qualified for the North American Finals again. Out of like 30 or 40 teams, they take the top eight. Mm-hmm. Last year, they came in second. They were the one seed this year. Mm-hmm. So they had high expectations. And to make a long story short, they got knocked to the loser's bracket about halfway through the tournament. To the team, no, that's a spoiler. They got knocked into the loser's bracket about halfway through. Worked their way through the loser's bracket because you have to lose twice to be eliminated. And got into the final against the team that knocked them into the loser's bracket, which was Ackworth, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Okay? And they rattled off four straight wins and won the North American Championship in epic fashion.
Grudge match.
Awesome. Grudge match. So if you want to see a little clip of this game, I have to. Just bear with me. I'm gushing about my kid right now, so I just want to say, if you want to see, if you go on to Twitter, at XP League, they have clips and highlights of the event and things that happened or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that when my son Bryce clinched the last round in the first best of three, the camera was on him. Mm-hmm. So they will cycle the camera through different players, and it just happened to be on him. And it was the match point. And he did something called an ace, which is where you kill everybody on the other team yourself.
Wow.
And he did it in a pretty incredible fashion. So in his first four bullets, each shot was a kill, which means you have to hit him perfectly in the head.
Wow.
Rattle off four shots and then killed the last guy. But all that to say, you can see this. It's on Twitter. If you scroll down a little bit, there's a video on there, and the description is, tag your favorite Valorant esports team because somebody needs to sign this kid. At CS Retro, which is Bryce's gamer tag. So if you want to see that, you can see it there. He's pretty the one cool. closest to the camera with the black hat on, if you're wondering. So
it's pretty cool.
That is pretty awesome. And if you have not watched any esports, watching the announcers on this watch them call the color commentary on this game. I mean, I'm sure were you able to hear that in the
audience? I was. They were close enough to where I could hear them out of my ear a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And they're hilarious.
Oh, they're absolutely hilarious. And to just absorb their enthusiasm because they are so attuned to what Bryce did with that ace. Right. They were just like
passing
out, just screaming about how amazing that was
to
finish the game in that way.
Yeah, so. it was epic, man. I was just happy to be a part of it, proud to be a part of it. Just really cool to see your kid in their element, doing their thing, you know, and just doing it well. Good stuff.
You know, you know, in my day, we did that in my mother's basement.
Exactly. It's crazy how far it's come.
Exactly. You got whooped for it, but yeah.
I mean, saw the videos.
Oh my gosh,
the smoke and the flashing lights and the laser beams and the music, and it was just top-notch production. Cool stuff.
Very cool, man. Like, I watch these feeds of these games, and I'm like, I'm a video gamer. I've played games my whole life, and I'm like, I can't comprehend what's happening on the screen right now.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot, and it's 5 hours worth of feed. You can actually watch it on, I guess I'll say this too, so if you go on YouTube Live at XP League HQ, you can see day two of the stream, the full stream. Mm-hmm. About halfway through that is their entire match with Ackworth, which is like 5 hours.
Right.
Because they had to play two best of threes, and they were just doing their thing. Pulled it out.
That's just crazy. You would, this age, I think I would be mental mush at the end of like having to concentrate that long. And
yeah, dude, they crazy. They stay focused. I was a mess. That was a torture session for me. It's crazy how stressed out you get for your kids.
Oh yeah.
I was thinking about that while he was playing. I mean, I played sports, baseball, basketball. I raced motocross. I used to race dirt bikes. Mm-hmm. I never got as nervous doing that myself as I was watching him.
Right.
Play a game. Mm-hmm. Stressed.
Yeah, yeah. I could totally relate.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Cool.
Now what?
I know, right? I was planning on talking about something else, but I've talked about that for so long, I'm just going to have to save it.
How do we follow that?
I know, right?
Gosh. Watching Chris glow here.
I know. I feel like I just bragged for 10 minutes, but I'll talk about it next time. Video game.
Ah, a new one.
Rabby Ribby.
Rabby Ribby? That's the name of it?
That's the name of it, yeah.
Is it a rabid frog?
No, it's a Metroidvania, actually.
Oh, you'll be talking about Alex because you're coming over to play.
Well, maybe I will be. So, yeah. I'll talk about both.
I have new one, too. I'm not ready to talk about it yet, though. I have to get a little bit further through it.
No, so. Don't even get the title? Do I get the title?
Inscription.
Not even heard of this.
It's a Devolver title. It's a card-based game.
Uh-huh.
I'm not far enough into it to be able to speak intelligently about it, but I've heard good things.
Interesting.
So it's like you're playing cards against an opponent.
Intrigued.
Yeah.
Rabby Ribby is a Metroidvania shmup. Shoot 'em up. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to stop. I really want to talk about it. I'm not going to. Okay. Cocktail time.
Yay, yay.
So because we're doing the So Hidden It's Unranked episode finally, which we've been wanting to do for a while, it doesn't get any more hidden than this, right? So we're talking about games on BGG that literally don't have a rating, or no, don't have a ranking because they have so few ratings, right? Mm. So they're very, very hidden. So I went to the internet to try to come up with some ideas, and I actually found a cocktail called the Hidden Gem Cocktail. So I was like,
wow.
You know?
How have we not found this before?
I know, right? What better time to use it than this? So the Hidden Gem Cocktail is 1.5 ounces of rum, 3/4 ounce lime juice, 3/4 ounce simple syrup, 2 ounces of, see if I say this right, Codornu Cava, which is a what again, Jason?
It's a sparkling Spanish white or rosé.
Yes, we looked that up before. Yes, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, and 6 to 8 mint leaves. So you muddle the mint leaves in the bottom of a shaker with simple syrup and lime juice, add the rum and shake, and then you top it with the cava. That's the Hidden Gem.
It's got a little bite to it that I like. I mean, yeah. It's a very interesting flavor.
Yeah.
I thought it was gin when he first brought it up. The mint
come through really well.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. It has totally different ingredients. I don't know why it reminds me. Maybe it's the mint, but it reminds me of a julep for some reason, like a rum julep.
So it'll be the cover item on the Hidden Gems cocktail. that gets made.
Okay. So just to wrap up here, as I had mentioned, we're doing the So Hidden It's Unranked episode. And the reason that we're doing this is this episode was actually recommended to us by our friend, our buddy, Dylan St. Clair. Mm-hmm. So when we were at Origins a year ago now,
It was a year ago.
Right, because just had Origins again this year, just ended. Mm-hmm. It's almost exactly a year. We were brainstorming with Dylan, and Dylan's just a really sharp, smart, witty dude, and he was just coming up with all these really cool ideas for shows and whatnot. And he's like, you know, you should do an episode where you review games that are so hidden they don't even have a ranking on BGG. And I was like, that's a really good idea. So we posted a thread on the Guild, and a lot of people commented on there about games that they really liked that were unranked. And so I was like, yeah, we can do an episode on this. So I pulled a game from those suggestions, and then I got a couple other games from another area. But if you guys are willing, I think we might do more than one of these because I find this to be pretty interesting, to be quite honest. And I know, Bill, you have a game.
I do.
That if we do another one, we'll definitely be on deck. That's kind of like a family game of yours.
Right. Yeah, my brother made it. So I think he has plans online if people like it. So, yeah.
But it has a BGG entry.
I don't think it does. Does it?
Oh, it totally does. We looked.
Okay, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay.
It definitely does. So more in store. But all that to say, the main reason we're doing this, I do want to shout this out really quickly, is I would bet a lot of our audience has probably heard this, but maybe not everybody. Dylan had a pretty bad accident a few months back where he had some head trauma, and it got pretty scary for a while there, like real scary. And he was in the hospital for quite a while. He is out now. He's going through therapy and things like that for part of his full recovery. But all to say, he's doing better now. The Dad's on a Map guy, who Dylan's also really close with, did a really cool thing. And they did a fundraiser for him to help pay for some of his medical expenses. And I reached out to him a week or so ago and said, hey, do you need some more help? We would be happy to do like a GoFundMe or something, because I knew I was going to talk about it on this episode. And I'm happy to report that all his expenses are covered and he's doing well. So we're excited about that.
That's good to hear.
That is so awesome. So awesome.
It was awesome to hang out with him last year at Origins, and hearing about that was just, it was hard to hear him going through that, but glad to hear he's doing well.
Yeah.
And all of our prayers and best wishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the kind of guy you hang out with a little bit and you just can't help but smile, just because he's got that kind of personality that's just over the top.
Totally. Just full life, fun to be around. And so we wanted to dedicate this episode to him. So Dylan, this one is for you. Thanks so much for the idea. And like I said, I hope to do it more in the future, depending on how these reviews go.
We shall see.
All right.
All right. Well, with that, should we get into the games?
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. All right.
Not a space there was between flag and standard. The earth's surface could not be seen. Not a space there was between the flag and standard. The range of Altai could not be seen. Points of lances gleamed, men's heads bobbed. The earth swayed on the point of collapse. Flags and golden standards fluttered, and the ground's splinting din could be heard. The army, marching with a terrible noise, was greater than the eyes could take in. Eyes were bowed with all the looking. Black plains, gray hills, the face of the earth was beaten down. Coats of mail all aglitter, racers and chargers bursting forth, neighing. The enormous warrior host set a moving with a crack.
That was beautiful.
So, for a little bit of context, so this game that we're about to talk about, Toga's Korgul, which we're probably pronouncing wrong.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Has its origin in Asia. So
Central Asia, yeah.
And primarily, I think, in Kyrgyzstan.
Yes.
And so I was looking up, obviously, there's no flavor text to this. It's like trying to find flavor text for chess, right? But there is an epic poem from Kyrgyzstan called The Epic of Manas.
Okay.
I think I'm saying that correctly. And it's actually kind of interesting. I was doing a little bit of reading about it. It's a 3 million line long poem.
No.
That takes about a month or to 2 months to recite from beginning to end.
No.
And it's continually being added to over time. So it chronicles this fantastical epic of Manas, but it also talks about the history of Kyrgyzstan and the people and their culture and all this stuff. And it's like this epic poem that includes all this stuff, has these spiritual elements to it. Traditionally, it can only be told by a Manaski. I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong. Is like a person who like trains and learns how to memorize this entire thing and speak the whole thing like in one setting and act it out and say it in the right ways and add the right emotions to it and all this stuff. So that was a little section of it.
Nice.
And the reason I chose that section was because this game was used as like a military training type of thing. It was meant to be we'll get into the mechanics of it, but the little balls that you're moving around represented warriors. And it was like,
among other things,
learning strategic battle thinking was how it was used. So it felt like it fit.
That's wild. I would like to think through a bit on how that game translates to strategy. But okay.
Sharpening the mind, Bill.
I guess so. I would not do well in that army. I'll admit right now.
Foreshadowing?
Bill be fodder. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Jason. Mm-hmm. So Togu's Kumalak. This is its entry on BGG, which means nine pebbles in Kazakh. But it's also known as Toga's Korgul, which means, and I much prefer this name, nine dung balls in Kyrgyz.
Yeah, way better.
So it's interesting you say that's supposed to represent soldiers, because I thought this was representing you're like seeding a field or something, or like fertilizing a field.
Yeah, that's just what I read on Wikipedia.
But yeah, that's
I also read that it means 9 sheep droppings.
Yes, yes, 9.
Maybe
that's
what they
balls.
Used as the pieces to move around. Which is
oh shoot, I bet you're right.
Yeah,
I have rabbits, and the balls in my game are very closely shaped to the balls that my rabbits poop out.
The rabbits are quite a bit smaller than goats. But
I'm glad that we didn't play it that way. So, thanks. For that.
It would work though. All right, so a little bit of history on Toga's Kurgul. So. It should be noted, like I said, it's called 9 pebbles or 9 dung balls. The number 9 has high significance in the folk beliefs and mythology of Central Asian peoples. So this game, as Jason said, is played in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and parts of Afghanistan, Russia, and Mongolia. It's thought that the game reached Central Asia by the Silk Road through the spread of Islam around the 12th century. The first tournament was, and yes, there are tournaments for this, more on this in a minute, was held in Kazakhstan in 1948.
Wow.
In 2008, the International Toga's Kumalak Federation was created, and there are tournaments held all over Central Asia and Europe, prominently scholastic tournaments. So, you know how we think about like our kids playing chess in school and tournaments like I did? This game is like that to them. In fact, this game has an annotation system, like chess does. So if you're familiar with chess, how you can annotate your moves and review your game, you can annotate this game and review it with a coach or a teacher.
Wow.
So that should just blow out any, there are dominant strategies in this game argument out of the water right away, Jason.
Yeah.
No, it should also just completely invalidate our opinions on it.
Probably, so. Much, exactly. Yeah. So we're coming in total noobs here. One more quick fact, it is estimated that there are about 10,000 organized players and about 200 official trainers in Kazakhstan alone.
Wow.
So this is a world game. This is not like an obscure game. It's obscure to us in the West, but actually in Central Asia, people will know what this game is.
I wonder when they have their tournaments, if they have them in like big auditoriums like Bryce did with black lights and the strobe lights and the rock and roll music.
It would be way cooler. But I've seen pictures. It actually reminded me of like a chess tournament.
Yeah.
How they're seated in these auditoriums at these fold-out tables. That's exactly what it looks like. Mm-hmm. So there you go. All right. Toga's Kurgul, as I mentioned, thought to be developed around 12th century. Publisher, nobody. More on that later. BGG ranking, unranked, obviously. Designer, uncredited. Who knows?
Wow.
Kind of similar to chess in that regard.
But that many people out there, I mean, they not know about BGG? I mean, who would? Why is it not on there?
It is on there.
It's
it
on just there. It's does just not ranked.
It does not have enough ratings to register a ranking.
Still, I mean, there's thousands of people that are playing it. So anyway, go ahead.
I think it has like 17 ratings on BGG. I don't know what the magic number is for it to finally pop a ranking, but it's not there.
How many ratings does chess have on BGG?
Oh gosh, I don't know, but several. I've ranked it or rated it rather. One more quick thing. How did we hear about this game? Well, this was a guild member recommendation on that thread that I was mentioning earlier. So thanks, Morton K, for recommending us check out this game. He mentioned it and it sounded interesting to me, so I picked it up.
So just out of curiosity, you said it didn't have a publisher. How did you pick it up?
I'll get to that.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, and how I got it.
Got it.
There's a story to this.
Okay.
All right. Brief rule summary for Toga's Kurgul. Toga's Kurgul is a Mancala-style game where the players are trying to capture the most dung balls. The game board consists of 18 pits, with each player controlling 9 pits on their side of the board. So I think it's important to understand right away that this game board has laterality to it. You have a side, your opponent has a side, 9 pits to a side, and it moves in a circular fashion, right? Mancala-style. So
there are no end pits, though, unlike Mancala.
Right, right.
There's no Mancalas.
Right, right, right. So basically, my rightmost pit would be adjacent to my opponent. Let's say Bill's leftmost pit moves in a circle like that.
Right. And the board is black and white for each side to differentiate it, really.
Yes, yes. You can tell there's a difference between the two sides.
Exactly.
At the beginning of the game, each pit will be seeded with 9 balls. Again, there's that magic number 9. Each turn, players will take turns sowing their seeds or their dung balls. If a pit contains more than one ball, the player will pick up all of the balls in that pit and drop one ball in each pit in a counterclockwise direction, starting with the pit that the player took the balls from. Of note, if there is only one ball in the pit, the player will place that ball in the next pit in the counterclockwise direction, so you don't pick it up and put it in the same one. You have to go to the next one if there's only one ball in the pit. Now, if the last ball placed brings the number of balls in that pit to an even number, and that pit is on the opponent's side, not on your side, but on your opponent's side, the active player or the player that caused that to happen captures all of the balls in that pit and places them into their holding area known as a kazan. Now, for a special case, if the last ball placed brings the number of balls in the pit to a total of 3, so not an even number, but exactly to 3, and again, the pit is on the opponent's side, the active player has created something known as a tuzdik, or a sacred place. The player will capture those 3 balls, and then they will place a marker in that bin. This is to remind the players that any time a ball would be dropped in that bin by either player, it is instead scored by the player who created that sacred place, and it is placed in their kazan for end-of-game scoring. A few special rules surrounding the sacred place. First, each player can only have one sacred place. 2, the last pit of your opponent cannot be turned into a sacred place. And 3, a sacred place cannot be placed symmetrically to your opponent's sacred place. So basically what that means is that if my 5th pit becomes Bill's sacred place, I cannot turn Bill's 5th pit into a sacred place for myself. The game ends once one player has no balls remaining on their side of the board. So in other words, they cannot make a move. At this point, if the opponent has any balls on their side of the board, they capture them and place them in their kazan. Players then total the number of captured balls in their respective kazans, and the player with the highest score wins. That's generally how you play 9 dung balls.
So simple.
So simple, right?
Yeah, sorry. Bill, tell us about how simple it is.
It is so simple.
All right, Bill, I'm going to tee it up for you here with a question.
All right.
So, thought a little bit about how I was going to lead into this one, because it's kind of a weird game to talk about, right? But the thing that kept coming to mind when I played it, and what I would be curious of what y'all thought was, did this game have an arc to it? Or I guess even probably a better way to say it than that is, do you feel like this game had phases? So, you know, we talk about in chess, we've mentioned that a few times already. I think it's a pretty apt comparison. Chess has an opening, It has a middle game, and then it has an end game.
Right.
Did you get that feeling from this game when you played it?
Yeah, there are phases to this game. Early in the game, it feels more, I say this hesitantly because it's probably not to somebody who knows how to play this game well, but it feels more chaotic because there's a lot more balls on the board and you're having to count a lot and try to figure out where everything's going to end up, and you're able to capture in a whole bunch of different ways. Towards the end game, everything gets a lot more sparse and it gets much easier to calculate.
Yes.
You can start to figure out, okay, well, if I do this, then you're going to do that. And, you know, it gets a little easier for us dumb Westerners who don't play this game often to figure out what's going on the board. But it also, you have less flexibility. You're not making these big captures anymore because there's usually not those types of moves available anymore. So, yeah, I definitely agree that that's there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, obviously, I asked this question for a reason. That came through really strongly for me. Again, with my chess background, It came through really strong, honestly. Again, as Jason said, I'm sure if you knew this game well or you had a coach or a teacher, I'm sure there are many different ways you can start this game. And I'm sure we were probably doing it very stupidly.
Mm-hmm.
Much like a person in chess pushes the rook pawn, not knowing any better, right? But the whole point of the opening.
Stupid people who push the rook pawn.
Yeah, those morons.
Who would do that?
Idiots. Yeah, it's just because you don't know, right? And so I think there's probably a component of figuring out how to set yourself up through an opening strategy to set yourself up for a middle game, which, as you guys mentioned, gets super complex because there are a lot of balls on the board. You have to account for a lot of changes in the pits. And then moving into the end game, which I do want to talk about a minute, because this was my favorite part of the game, actually. Much for the reason why Jason said is, it was where I finally started to feel like I could calculate a few moves ahead, in some cases several moves ahead.
Right.
Much like you can in a chess end game, like if you had kings and pawns on the board, and thinking it through, okay, well, if I do this, he has to do this, because if he doesn't do that, then I can do this. And then because I know he's going to do this, now I'm going to do this, and you can begin to work through the permutations. And I found that actually very fun, that part of the game, personally.
Yeah, that 30 seconds of the game was awesome.
It wasn't that short.
No, that's the thing. That's what I was going to say, is that the end game is not 30 seconds long. If I had a complaint about this game, it would be that the end game felt like it dragged on forever. Because at some point, it becomes like you are stalling. Because the game ends when a player runs out of moves,
right?
Which I think is how Mancala ends too, right? And when that happens, you claim all the remaining dung balls on the board, right? So it becomes this game of holding out, of how many permutations of moving these five pebbles around my side of the board can I make to draw out my side as long as possible to force my opponent to have to run out of moves before I do, right? That's a cool part of the strategy to the game.
Yeah, I thought so.
And maybe we're just playing slow, but it made it take a really long time sometimes to actually feel like you're making progress through the end game, because you're staring at like 20 more pebbles on the board and you're like, it's going to take me 50 moves to run out of moves here.
Yeah.
But it's a minor complaint, I guess.
I mean, to me, the painful part was if you made a mistake early and somebody got a couple of big bins on you,
yeah,
it felt like the game was out of control. And so then, to me, that's when the end game...
It's like losing your queen.
Right, losing your queen. And then when
Do that, Bill.
Exactly. Then the end game felt really painful. But I could see if the game's tight and you're ending up in the end game and you're trying to figure out, you know, how do I get these last pieces if they matter, would be really, really cool.
Well, I feel like you and I had a game like that.
Oh, no, you were kicking my ass.
I mean, it wasn't that much of a difference.
Oh, my gosh, yes. It was overwhelmingly different. So.
Well, I guess I can say I was enjoying squeezing every point out of it, just trying to figure out how to maximize points. There is, without a doubt, strategies and how you break up your groups or... I could see how it could be really slow and annoying, but just a simple, what I thought of as like a delay move, where you just take a single ball and you drop it in the next bin. Again, I guess that can be perceived as being slow, but you can force your opponent to make a move they don't want to make by doing things like that. And again, I just bring it back to chess. I mean, again, I played it my whole young life. Chess endgames can be 70 moves long, you know? And that's just how this game can be, right? It can be a lot of movement happening without a lot of like, oh, I just captured 12 balls, which is exciting. But I enjoyed the finesse and the what's the word I'm looking for? The subtlety.
Nuance. Yeah,
the subtlety that happened in that phase of the game.
Right. So one thing I want to point out too, and it's just kind of the nature of the game, is it's like a whirlpool, right? Everybody's going in the same direction. And as you're adding these dung balls into all these pots all the way around, the stacks will kind of ebb and flow on what side of the board they get big on. To me, it's such a fascinating challenge to think through actually preparing for that situation, right? Mm-hmm. How do you prepare for those stacks and kind of the late mid game, I'll even call it. Well, where they end up so that they're at your most
or maybe preventing them from even forming. Because, you know, we had mentioned in our games, having a bin with a lot of balls in it is kind of a liability.
Right.
And if it gets so many in it, as you mentioned, it will wrap around the board.
Yeah.
Ideally, what you want to do is to end on your opponent's side so you can capture. But if you get so many balls in a bin, it will actually wrap around your opponent's side and end on your side.
Right.
Which doesn't hurt you necessarily, but you're not capturing anything when that happens, right?
Well, not only that, but if you have like two or three of those really big bins, especially late game, I think your opponent can manipulate you so they can get access to one of those, and there's like not a lot you can do about it. So
you have less options of moves that you can make that are like no-op moves, right?
Right.
Because now I have to move one of these big bins, and it's spreading everything out super thin. And probably spreading it out to my opponent's side. So it's reducing my available move count.
Right. And for you sacrificing that, you might be opening up a medium-sized stack for your opponent to take.
Especially if you miscount.
Yeah, especially if you miscount. And that's one of the things.
Which we should probably talk about that, right?
Yeah, miscounting and the fiddly nature of it. Yeah. It's easy to,
Go ahead, Jason.
There's a lot of counting in this game. A lot of it. You're counting out. Okay, I think there's 13 balls in there, so that means one stays here, and then count. All right, I think it's going to land in that basket over there. I'm sure if you're experienced at this, you can figure that out. The bins, they're numbered. At least were on the set that Chris had, which I guess if you can do math, helps you. But it gets confusing because if you wrap around the board or if you don't go all the way around the board, the counting is different. So it got for us people who are not experienced playing this game, it got very complicated, especially early game, figuring out all the counting. To be fair, I think components matter.
Yes.
And I feel like we should talk about the components that you had for this game and how that maybe made this a little more difficult than it needed to be. I think the ideal setup for this game would be that there are like two parallel channels in each bin where you can see the balls line up and you can count them a little more easily.
You can quickly identify if it's an even or odd number in the bin, right?
Right. We had kind of this weird 3D printed board.
It was definitely 3D printed for sure.
That the channels didn't quite line up, so the balls were always slightly staggered and rolling around all weird, and you could never really tell how many were in there, and that just made it take longer.
Yeah.
Well, because not only do you have to count where it ends, you're influencing every other bin from where you start to where you end.
That's so big.
Right. And then you have to figure out what did you just allow for every one of those bins that
you're
touched.
Oh, shoot, I just made that odd. And now because I dropped that pebble in there, now he has six in there, which means he can now reach that bin and capture all those balls.
Exactly.
And you're like, crap.
There are so many things to keep in your head at once. It's just crazy for an old man.
And then you drop one ball and it rolls under the board and nobody notices.
Right. Or you accidentally drop two in one and you didn't know. No, you did.
All right. So, interesting thoughts. It's definitely going where I thought it would. Things we need to talk about. But one more thing we need to mention, I think, is the sacred place.
Yes.
As I had mentioned. So, this is, I think, a thing that the game adds. It just gives you another thing to think about and consider. There's another decision point or wrinkle. And that if you create a bin on your opponent's side that has exactly three balls in it, you have now created a permanent capturing place where not only if you place a ball in there, but even if your opponent moves through there and drops the ball in there, you capture it. It becomes yours, right?
This is the most fascinating part of this game.
Yeah, yeah. What'd you think about it?
I thought it was really interesting trying to figure out what is the ideal place to try to position this, right?
Yeah, and when, right?
Well, I mean, I feel like the earlier the better, right?
True.
But
what if you have an option of, oh, I can create a sacred place or I can capture in a bin and capture 12 balls?
Yeah,
what is
that's true.
Better, right?
That's true, yeah.
You know?
But in terms of the placement, it's like you can place it close to your end, which means that you have a lot of control.
Right.
Right. Because now every time I move across to the other side, I'm scoring a point for myself, which gives me a lot of control. Or you can place it at the other end, which means you're like a thorn in the side of your opponent, right?
Right?
Because now every time they try to move a ball to the opposite side, they're giving you one.
Right.
Right.
My feeling is that's a don't care. Because the same flow of balls are going around, right? So I think all you need to do is get there early. And really, it's a defensive game to try to make it occur as late as you possibly can that they get their sacred place on your spot. Because it's going to move. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's just one of those things you got to calculate. It's like, okay, do I give up this 10 bin so I don't create that two?
Which is tempting.
Yeah.
But it can hurt you. I remember I watched Jason and Ken play a game, actually. There were three of us, and I wanted Jason to play it, and I was watching them. And Ken looked like he was ahead most of the game, but Jason got one of those sacred places early, and he just terrorized him in the end game. Because Ken just had to keep putting balls in there, and Jason was forcing him to. And it ended up costing him that game, actually, because he was able to get that over there.
Did we ever see a game where both people got one relatively early?
I think you and I had one.
Did we have one where we both had one pretty early? Yeah,
because I got one really early on you, too, in the game that I played against you, Bill. And
It was painful.
I smoked you in that.
I was like, it was a visit to the dentist office, so as it was that game was.
So we like it.
the
sacred place.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think it's a cool component.
Any other burning thoughts, or shall we move on to final thoughts?
I'm good.
Well, before we do, we haven't done this in like 20 episodes.
Uh-oh.
Should we go through our scoring system? I always mean to do this, and I always forget. I guess I'm just assuming people are going back and listening. We probably should, because, you know, we're bad hosts. Okay. Really quick. Hidden Gem rates games on a 1 to 6 scale, if you didn't know, unless you listened to episode 23. If we give a game a 1, it means we don't like the game, and we don't like the game because we feel like it's flawed in some way. There's some sort of design issue with it that makes it unplayable and just unfun. A 2, we also dislike the game, but it's not because there's any sort of issue with the design. It's just we don't find the game enjoyable. We don't like it. We don't ever really want to play it again. Just not for us. See Phoenicia. Number three, that's the meh game. That's the game that's, you know, it's not bad, but it just didn't really do anything for us. It's just fine. You know, we're not really seeking to play out again. It's just meh. Now, number four, this is where we start getting into the good stuff. A four means we like this game. We enjoyed playing it. If somebody was like, hey, I want to play this game, be like, yeah, I'll play it. I enjoy that game. It's good. Five, above average, a great game, an excellent game. Would never turn it down, anxious to introduce the other people. We think it's really cool. And then six are our favorite games, top games, a Hall of Fame game for us, you might say, some of our most favorite games. Okay. Having said all that, Bill.
Yeah.
Why don't you start us off?
Okay. I would rather watch Teletubby reruns over and over again than play this game again. No, that, I mean, that's not quite true. It's totally not the game's fault. I just, my mind is just not wired for this game. I mean, I played both, you know, Jason and Chris, and they shellacked me in both the games. Actually, the Jason's game, it turned out to be way closer in the end, and it wasn't necessarily due to...
It's because I ran out of moves.
We ran out of moves, yeah. But it was a strategy, right? Because I had a bunch of dung balls on my side, and Jason didn't, and so I was able to collect a bunch at the end. It wasn't enough to get me anywhere close, and so instead of losing by 30, I lost by, you know, 10 or something. So that was kind of cool. I could see that being a good game, and I can see why there is... you know, a great following, because it is super strategic, but I think you really have to be a math head, and you have to enjoy the counting out. And I could just see a savant being able to look at a board and just figuring it all out at once. I am just not that savant. So for me, I gave it a 2 just because of me, but it's not the game's fault. It's absolutely 110% not the game's fault. If you're thinking about this game and hearing about it and think that you like it, I would give it a 5 from a purely strategic point of view, that if you like games that are like that, this game is for you. I hated Mancala. I would never play Mancala again either, but this game just falls in that category. So,
okay, makes sense. Mancala from Hell, as you called it.
Mancala from Hell, absolutely. My daughter liked to play it, and I was like, oh my God, please, no. But I played it.
Yeah, for me, I've never been a huge fan of Mancala either, although I do love Trajan. That is one of my more favorite games.
Yeah, Five Tribes.
Yeah, Five Tribes has a little bit of that too. I think that games of this nature are not really my style. And I say that fully admitting that chess is not really my style. Mm-hmm. Like, as much as you love chess, Chris, I've played chess. I know some basic, very basic strategy to chess, but it's just never been a thing that has drawn me in of like, man, I really want to learn how to get super good at the deep level strategy of this game. And I think that's what this type of game takes. It takes wanting to dig deep into the mathematical nuance of the strategy. And I think it's there. It's absolutely there.
For sure.
Right? This game wouldn't be as popular as it is if it wasn't there. People wouldn't be playing tournaments of it. So it's definitely there, and the game supports all of that deep level thinking and strategic forward thinking and planning six moves ahead if you can figure that out in your head. I cannot, and maybe this is just a sign of the times of my current stress level, but like, I don't have the time to like figure that out. Now, that said, there are parts of this game that really intrigue me, like the sacred place thing, trying to figure that out, even just the mathematical part of it. I mean, I have a fairly mathematical brain. I'm a computer programmer. That said, I appreciate that part of the game for sure. There is a part of me that's like, man, I really want to play this against somebody who's like really good at it, mm-hmm. and see how they play it, mm-hmm. see how they would destroy me, I'm sure, and like learn from that. I don't know anybody who's in that category.
Right.
So it would be hard to figure that out, but I would like absolutely love to play it again more against somebody who really knows what they're doing. All that to say, I was weirdly between a 3 and a 4 on this one, because I think that it's a good game and there's a part of me that is drawn to it that I'm like, man, I kind of want to see somebody play this really well. Like,
yeah,
I want to watch somebody play a really, really strategic, good game of this. But if I really take a step back and I have to give this an honest rating, I think I fall in the 3 category of like, would I seek this out and continue to want to play this over and over again going forward? Probably not. So like Bill, I think I fall in the category of I give this like a 4 or 5 as a game,
mm-hmm.
because I think that it is a cool game and I think that it takes Mancala to a whole nother level.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of strategy and deep thinking that goes with it. For me personally, I don't know that I will continue down that path, just like I won't continue down the path of trying to learn how to get better at chess.
And or Hungarian Tarok.
Or Hungarian Tarok. And that's just a personal thing for me. But I would still highly encourage anybody who is drawn to this type of game to check it out and see if it's for you.
Cool. Nice thoughts, guys. All right, so I think you both summed it up really well by saying this game is not for everybody. For sure. It's definitely not. This is definitely a lifestyle game. Mm-hmm. Could totally see how if you had an uncle from Kazakhstan or something, right. He'd be like, I love this game and I've played it since I was 8 and I'm awesome at it. I'm sure there are many, many people out there like that. Fortunately, we don't know many of them. But I would say for me, I'm just going to come out and say I liked this game. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. And I think the reason that I know the reason I like this game is because I love chess. And it gave me chess feels. Now, they're very different games. But again, there's an opening, a clear middle game, and a clear end game resonated with me so strongly. Mm. It just gave me those chess feelings. And I just enjoyed it that it was chess-like in a way, but very different. Mm. You know, my brain was working in a little bit different way. Now, I don't like it as much as chess by any means. But I still really enjoyed it. I'm going to give this game a 4. I liked it. I'm glad that I have it. I consider this game one of those games. Some people call these curio games. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of like weird oddities that you have in your collection that not many people have. And this is like a curio game for me that like most people would be like, what the heck is that? And I'm like, well, let me tell you about it. It's really neat.
You should get a better set then.
Yeah.
Right.
Make Cameron make you one from scratch.
That would be cool, actually. Yeah, if he would, because my set kind of sucks.
Get on that, Cameron. 162 wooden balls. Go for it.
The balls you can reuse. Just the board. Like the little dimples to put them in.
Exactly. So they don't roll around.
Yeah.
So I guess we should talk about where you can find this game. Nowhere. So
sticking with your business model.
Yeah. So you can call Cameron at Sturdy Bones and maybe he'll make you one. I got mine on Etsy, and I'm almost sure it was 3D printed. Now, before that, listen to this, okay? This is crazy. I was looking on eBay because I could not find a board anywhere, and I found a board. The game board looked like it had a picture of two kids playing Toga's Kurgul, and it was like $35 and like $15 shipping or something from Kazakhstan.
Oh, wow.
I was like, that's pretty reasonable. I was like, I'm going to get this board. It looks good, right? So I wait for it to show up for like several weeks. Finally, I get a notification. It's like, your package has arrived. You know how eBay will notify you?
Right.
And I walk out on the porch and I walk out on the side door. I'm like, where's the box? I can't find the box. And I tell Ty, I'm like, Talia, have you seen a box anywhere? Did you pick up a box? And she's like, no, I haven't seen any box. I was like, and so I'm like, couldn't be in the mailbox. So I walk out to the mailbox.
Oh, no.
There is a letter from Kazakhstan.
Oh, gosh.
I open the letter, and it was a stamp of a picture of two people playing Toga's Kurgul. I paid $35 for a stamp.
Genius.
Wow. I have to see this stamp now.
Well, I threw in the trash. I was so mad. Plus shipping for a stamp. Of two people playing Toga's Kurgul.
It's probably
so buyer beware, people. Make sure you know what you're getting.
Some stamp collector somewhere probably would have paid you at least asking price for that.
Dude, yeah. I am telling you, I am sure I got swindled because I went back and looked at the page again and they make it look like you're getting the game.
Right.
It really looks like you're getting the game, but it was a stamp.
Wow.
Did you have to mail your check to a prince?
Really, I was going to say, I was going to make a prince joke out of that, but that's a good one.
Anyways, yeah. So, just be careful out there. Don't buy stamp. Buy the game.
All right. Well, those are our thoughts on stamps and Toga's Kurgul.
In the Kismet sector of the Rakrok Galaxy, huge self-sustaining motherships fight over control of vast natural resources. But there's heavy opposition. In Conquest at Kismet, you play as one of two races vying for control of the Kismet sector in the Rakruk Galaxy. This simple game uses a lottery-like method of resolving battle, something that's never been used in a card game before. This allows for a very small table footprint, while having a healthy mix of tactics and luck.
That's awesome, Chris.
I wasn't expecting it to go into so many game mechanics. I got a little tickled there. I was hoping for a little more narrative, yeah, you know, but right. This is what I got. I was going to do a second take, but I'm keeping it. I like it.
Yeah. It is unranked after all.
That's true. Had to get in and out.
All right. Conquest at Kismet, published in 2015 by Victory Point Games, designed by Jay Vales, and of course, BGG Rank. It's not. So.
Can I talk about how I found it real fast?
Yes.
Quickly. What's that?
I suppose.
That's fast. So this was not recommended, but if we're going to continue to do this as a series from time to time, mm-hmm. what I did was I went to Dice Tower. They do something called Week in Review, mm-hmm. where they go through every game they review during the week and summarize, basically. So I went back as far as I could go, first episode, and started working towards the present to see how long it would take me to find a game that they ranked favorably, mm-hmm. 7 or higher, that is unranked on BGG. Wow. And it only took me 3 episodes, and I found this game.
Oh, wow.
That was how I got it. So, working backwards, Z Garcia reviewed this actually and gave it a 7 out of 10.
Okay.
Which for them is good.
Right.
And like I said, it's unranked on BGG. So, that's how we found this one.
Cool. All right. Well, quick rules summary. Conquest at Kismet is a 2-player asymmetrical game. It is a space battle to the death between 2 factions, Trice and Storm. Each player begins with a mothership card and a large deck of additional cards, randomly comprised of support, ability, and combat cards. On a player's turn, they'll go through a series of phases. This game is very procedural in that way. Mm-hmm. After which, the opposing player will perform those same phases, and this goes back and forth until one player's mothership has been destroyed. So let's go through the phases. Starting out on a player's turn, the active player collects energy tokens equal to their current energy production. So players will spend these energy tokens in order to play cards from their hand for their abilities or their support or whatever they happen to provide. They will then draw their hand of cards up to their limit, which is usually 7 cards. Not always, but usually. Then the next phase is the time phase. I'm going to kind of skip over this one and come back to it because it won't make a whole lot of sense if I explain it now. After that, the player gets to deploy cards. So at this point, they can deploy support cards from their hand. These represent like supporting ships. So you have your mothership and then you have the other ships around you that comprise your fleet, I guess. These cards have abilities on them or they have an effect that happens one time when the card is played. In order to do this, the player has to pay the energy costs and they can't exceed their support limit, which is usually 3. So you can't have more than 3 support ships around you at any given point. I mentioned that these cards have abilities. It's important to note that some of these cards, when their ability is used, they have a cooldown time. So the card will get rotated 2 or 3 times in a clockwise direction. And then during the time phase, which I skipped over, when you reach the time phase, the card will rotate 90 degrees at a time. And once it returns back to an orientation where it's facing the player, then the card becomes available to you again. So it's like representing a large weapon that you're firing and it takes time for it to reset. Mm-hmm. So you might lose it for a couple turns and then you get it back. After that point, the final phase is battle stations. So at this point, the active player chooses whether they're going to attack their opponent or pass. If you pass, it just goes to the opponent's turn and they go through the same phases. If you attack, a couple more procedural things happen. So the active player has to decide what card or what ship he is attacking. He can either attack the mothership or one of the supporting ships. Then, starting with the attacker and alternating back and forth, players will play 1 card at a time face down to a central pile in the middle of the table. This is important.
Yep.
This will go back and forth, players playing a single card face down until one player passes, at which point the other player can play as many additional cards as they want, and then at that point it's closed. Once that happens, the whole stack of cards goes to the defender. The defender will shuffle the cards without looking at them, and then the attacker draws a single card. And essentially, if the card that they draw is their own card, their attack is successful. If the card they draw is their opponent's card, the attack fails. So that's the kind of the simplified version of this. Throughout that process, a whole bunch of other things are happening.
Yeah.
So ability cards factor into this in that you can play ability cards at any time. They can affect all kinds of different things about the battle. There are also combat cards, which combat cards get played into the center of the table just like any other card. However, combat cards have some sort of effect that influences the battle if they are the card that is drawn.
Right.
The single card that gets drawn that determines whether it's a successful attack or not. If that card is a combat card, whatever's printed on it in the combat section will influence the result of the battle. Many times that's like increasing the hit points of the attack.
Or if you're the defender even, and your card gets pulled, there are some cards that have text on them that will
Or can have a defensive side.
Like lose a support ship or do damage or whatever.
Or the damage that would have been done is instead done to you.
Exactly. Kind of
Once an attack is successful, if it is successful, the damage done to the ship that was targeted is the base attack value of the mothership, which is usually one, can be modified by other cards and can be added to by combat cards. Each player's mothership has a base strength of 12. So once one player has taken 12 hits, their mothership blows up and they lose. So
eliminated.
I want to do the Flight of the Conchords.
I thought you were going to say that.
I can't think of what it is now. I poked it. It was bad. So that is a quick summary. Well, actually, that's pretty much all the rules to conquest at Kismet. So to kick us off here, unlike Toga's Korgul, this game is highly thematic, or it's trying to be. It's meant to be a space battle between these two very asymmetrical factions. I think one of the factions is like the space alien bugs, and the other faction is, I don't know, humans or something.
An advanced race of some kind.
High tech.
So did you guys get that sense from this game? Did you feel like it was a tense space battle that was going on, or did you just feel kind of like a card flipper with lots of procedural aspects to it?
Well, I thought it had great theme. It made me think of Cameron. It's like, Cameron, you should be here, man. This is cool. The outfitting of your ships, the choices that you have on what you're doing versus combat, I thought it was a pretty cool themed game. What do you think, Chris?
I totally agree. And I was not expecting this. This is my game, like most of them are. I had not played this game before. And I knew that they were named differently and the cards were different. But I didn't really grasp what the designer was trying to do and make it feel like how the deck was designed. So what I mean is, one of them is the bugs, right?
Right.
And about halfway through Bill and I's first game, we were like, oh, we're swarming the other person. So basically that deck throws a lot of cards into the combat pile, which may or may not hit hard. You may not hit for anything, actually.
Right.
But you may negate an attack or cause your opponent not to hit you, but you're swarming the deck.
Right.
Whereas the other deck has like a lot of satellites and radars and antennas, and it's supposed to, I think, represent you striking very precisely. There's a lot of cards you kind of hold back for a really well-timed play, and it feels more precision-tuned. And I think that's what he was going for, this more primitive, not really primitive, just more sheer force, mass bugs versus this kind of more technologically advanced race, which I thought came through really well, honestly.
Yeah, each mothership has a special ability, and it's blue and red. And on the blue, which was the tech team, its superpower was when it was attacking, if you flipped over a card that was not in your favor, you could flip over again.
Yeah.
With the red one, it was you could add two additional cards to the combat pile before you ever began. That was from the top of your pile.
So, increasing your odds.
Exactly. So to Chris's point about flooding people with things, there were a lot of cards and support cards and stuff like that.
But not as precise because you don't know what you're flooding in there.
Exactly. So, so you had kind of less tactics in a way.
Right.
But you could have maybe twice as many cards in the middle as the tech team did.
It changes how you... Let's just put it this way because I want to hear Jason's thoughts, but you play them differently.
Right.
You will definitely change how you play depending on what side you're playing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the asymmetricalness of it really came through in a good way. A lot of games claim to be asymmetrical and it's like you have one little extra power. It influences how you play. I found the tension of the space battle theme came through really strongly in the offense versus defense nature of the card play.
We should definitely talk about this. Go for it.
So this lottery system that has never been done before in any card game before. Basically, a battle is you throw as many cards as you can into this central pile in order to up the odds so that this one card that gets drawn out, the one lottery ball that gets pulled out is one that belongs to you.
Right.
And ideally, it has a special ability on it that also helps you out. But what's interesting about that is that you can, as the attacker, flood the deck with every card you've got. You can say, well, I've got 7 cards. I'm going to throw them all into the central pile, and I'm just going to up this stack so that my attack goes through.
Right.
But you're giving up the ability to refine your attack with additional strength through the support cards. And even more importantly, you don't get more cards until after your opponent's gone.
Yep.
So they have the opportunity to attack you back. And if you don't have any cards in your hand, mm-hmm. you have nothing to seed into the deck for their attack against you.
To defend yourself.
So right. you're constantly trying to figure out this balance of, okay, well, how many cards do I want to spend on support for things that actually boost my abilities or give me defense or give me all these special things? How much do I just want to throw as raw firepower against my opponent when I am attacking so that I can actually have a successful attack and not just throw away cards? But how many of those do I need to hold back so that I actually have some defense
right.
yep. against the attack that I know is coming right after that? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, and I want to add one thing to you. I totally agree with everything you said. Just one additional fine point. You said I can throw every card I have in my hand to try to hit you to increase my odds, and that will increase your odds of your card getting pulled. But that might also not be good because some of these attack cards of yours will say like +4.
Right.
And you want that to get pulled, right? But some of them say +1.
Or nothing.
Mm-hmm. And it does something else. Maybe it's a support card that doesn't contribute attack. Great, it got pulled. My opponents didn't get pulled, but I actually don't even damage you. So you have to balance, how many cards do I actually want to put in here? Or in other words, will I be happy if this card gets pulled?
Right.
Right? Because, yeah, you didn't get pulled, but I didn't really do what I wanted to do. Maybe I just throw 2 or 3, like +3 or +4s in there, hope they get pulled. And if they don't, well, at least I have a lot of cards in my hand to defend. Mm-hmm. There's actually right. a lot more to think about there. It is a lucky card draw, but there's a lot of decision space that goes into that process, I think.
Right. Because on some of the cards, they'll have like +3 attack, right? That will add to your ship. I will just add to what you just said, Chris. You always do one, right? Because your mother
always do at least one.
Yeah, you always do at least one.
With your mothership.
Right. But it feels like that's not a very successful
turn. Yeah, you want to do more than that. Yeah.
Absolutely. But there are cards that will have 2 different sections, right? That'll have an attack section, and then some of them will have a defend section. Like you're saying, that if this card is drawn with you as a defender, it can do something as great as removing a support ship or reflecting the damage that was done to you back to the other one. So you don't want to use that on attack. So I appreciated the challenge of thinking through both those things. It was funny, when I played Jason, I drew the blue deck, and I was going into it thinking 110% that I was going to automatically win. When Chris and I played, the blue team won every time.
Right, yeah.
And I think it comes down to that strategy of what you're just saying with the red deck. It seems like it's designed that you need to flood the yes. middle, because the blue deck can opt to throw away that first card, which is a very powerful
yeah.
way to influence the battle. And so the bad part for the reds or the bugs is when you're flooding the deck, exactly like you said, you don't know what's in there. You might mm-hmm. have some great attack cards, you might not, but that's kind of the only strategy you can use, I thought. But Jason won with the red deck with yeah. me, so there must be more strategies there than I fully appreciate.
Yeah, there's definitely way more strategies.
Way more strategies.
I was strategizing all over you.
That's what I thought. No,
I say that facetiously. And that brings me to another point that I kind of want to get y'all's opinion on. So this lottery mechanic is interesting. You do have a lot of control over what you're doing, but ultimately it still kind of comes down to a lucky draw.
Sure.
Right? And Jason complaining about randomness. this isn't a complaint necessarily. It's more a curiosity question. I found it felt sometimes kind of swingy. Yes, the randomness is there, sure. But you can do a ton of damage in one shot, oh, right? Absolutely. So like,
yeah,
even though I won the game that we played, Bill, there was one round where I threw everything I had at you. There was like 2 +4 cards in there, a +3 card, so much stuff. I probably had 8 cards in there, and you had like 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. And you drew your own card on the first draw. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, great. I just spent my entire deck and all of my top firepower on pretty much a guaranteed hit and missed it.
Nothing's guaranteed.
And if I had been successful, the other side of that is if I had been successful, I would have done like 8 damage to you. It would have ended the game after like the third round. I don't know. This is meant to be like a quick 20 to 30 minute game.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you just have to know that it's meant to be a quick 20 or 30 minute game, and it could swing pretty heavily in one direction or the other.
Yeah,
because like right after that, you did an attack to me and attacked me for like six or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it goes quick, and it could end on the flip of a card, basically. It's not like this long, drawn-out thing where you have time for that randomness to sort of settle out. And I guess if you're playing multiple games, it would do that.
Yeah. But
it's short enough that that randomness does have a bit more of an impact.
Yeah.
So just something to be aware of.
I don't disagree with you. I had that listed as a minor con in that, just like you said, you can get whacked in this game. It happened to me a couple times too, where, and I'll preface that by saying, if the stars align, and I might be being a little hyperbolic because that implies like super rare. It's not super rare, but I would say it's uncommon for you to just get hit for eight. It requires a lot of things to kind of work out, right? Mm-hmm. But having said that, it can happen. You can just get whacked, and it can be hard to come back from that. But like you said, it is a short game. So maybe a minor con didn't bother me too much. As to your card not getting pulled out of the pile, that can be annoying, especially if you committed a lot. But I guess for me, that annoyance was outweighed by at least, if not control, the illusion of control the game gave me. I did feel like the things that I were doing were at least, I was improving my odds of good things happening for me. And hopefully they did, and hopefully they didn't. But in a 20 to 30 minute game,
I guess we're never really in control, are we?
No, we're not. You just can't, unless you're playing Toga's Core Goal.
You never really
know
if you're going to buy a house and then the sink's going to have a rotten cabinet underneath it. You know?
If that makes sense, that would be my answer, I guess. What do you think, Bill?
That's fair.
Yeah, I kind of agree. To talk a little bit about some of the capabilities of things in the support ships, one of the things that they allowed you to do was to draw more cards. And some of the ability cards would let you draw three from your stack and, you know, choose two of them to combat things. And so there was some strategic choices on what you kept that allowed you to feel good about what went into that combat pile and or what support ships you had. And then when you're attacking the other person, do you attack their ship or do you get rid of that support ship that is giving them extra cards every time so that they're not going to have that ability against you?
Decision points.
So there were, so to me, there were some interesting parts there that even though, yeah, they're random, there were things you could do to reduce that randomness. Because I know, like, Chris, when I was playing you, I had like 11 or 12 cards in my hand.
Oh,
sometimes.
I feel like you were drawing cards like crazy and it was driving me nuts.
Right.
Like, how do you still have so many cards?
Right.
You were playing the bugs, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So to me, I found that part, I don't know, it just didn't bother me, I guess. I felt like there were things that you could do for and against that randomness.
And one more thing about the hand management, and you kind of mentioned it, but I just want to reiterate. We've been talking about holding cards back to defend, but you can draw a card and not use it to attack or defend, just to hold it for a future round.
Right?
Like when I played as blue, especially, there were a couple of cards I held for like multiple rounds, waiting for the perfect time to play them. Right. There's one card that's just like you cancel their attack.
Right.
And that's a killer, right? Yeah. But that card was taking up space in my hand for a few hands until I played it at the right time. I could have thrown that in defense to just try to gum up
or destroy your opponent's support ship card.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, there's things to think about there, right?
Right. I did the same thing with Jason. When he won, I knew that I had the next one because I had a setup so I could draw three times in case I failed, and then I had a card that I could play to double my attack. So, I mean, I just knew the math was going to work out that I was going to win, but he ended up, he killed me with a seven, right? I mean, he needed seven and he got seven. I was like, holy crap. it sucked.
I guess those are the moments that make the game epic, yeah.
Right. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right.
If you could guarantee winning, then it wouldn't be interesting.
Right.
All right. Final thoughts time?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, I guess I can kick us off this time.
Okay.
So, I enjoyed this game. I have not played many asymmetrical games that felt as asymmetrical as this one did while still feeling fair and balanced. And so, I enjoyed learning the different decks, figuring out what was in there, trying to figure out how to balance that offense versus defense. The randomness factor of it annoyed me at times, but as much as I complain and gripe about that all the time, I recognize the fact that randomness is required in games in order to make them interesting, right?
Yeah, right.
In a lot of cases, not always. So I enjoyed even that part of it. And it's a quick game. And so I think for what it's trying to do, it accomplishes it pretty well. It adheres to the theme pretty well. It feels like it's supposed to feel. Yeah, and I enjoyed trying to figure out all the different balances between all the various cards that you have. There's a good amount of variety in the decks.
Yeah,
it's not just like five or six different cards, and then you have, you know, seven of each of them. Right.
Right.
There are a lot of cards in here. Yeah. There are duplicates, but there are a lot of cards to think about and read. And I enjoyed it. So I gave this game a 4.
Nice. Okay. So for me, I think I've said on the show before, I don't play two-player games that often. I just usually find that I prefer playing with higher player counts just generally. But I do find that when I play two-player games, I often have a good time. I'm like, why don't I do this more? I don't know why I'm weird. But this game gave me that feeling. I was like, I'm enjoying this. This is fun. It actually reminded me a lot of Revolver when Cameron and I played Revolver together, which is an asymmetrical head-to-head two-player card game we reviewed back in like episode 15 or something. I think this game just surprised me. I mentioned, I think, last episode, you know, sometimes you'll read the rules to a game and you're like, this game sounds awesome, and you play it. It was last episode because that was Northern Pacific. You're like, this game sucks. And there are other times you read rules and you're like, oh boy.
Lottery-based
combat
system.
Yeah. I read that and I was like, this is not going to be good. I was like, you throw all these cards in and hope your single card pulls out. This is going to suck.
Right.
But in execution, actually playing it out and understanding all the other things to consider, what cards you add, how many cards you add, how many cards you hold back, it actually worked really well. This game surprised the heck out of me. I was fully expecting to dislike this game. I liked it. I am like right on the 4 or 5 line.
Wow.
I'm going to give it a 4, but it's close. And I would say, and we didn't mention this in review, but I guess one con is because this game didn't really take off, so to speak, there aren't more decks. If this game had like 3 or 4 more faction decks, I would give this game a 5.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
For more variability. I wish it had more. I think that was the intent, and it just never got enough traction for that to happen. But this is a good game. It really is. I recommend this one. Give it 4.
Awesome. Cool. So I think I've said before, I've been listening to board game designer podcasts. And one of the ones I was listening to talked about, if you want to design a game, it's often good for early designers to pick a card game to do, because you can buy the card stock really cheap. And then it's just easy to take a Sharpie and, you know, write whatever you think the powers are in the card and just try that. This feels a little bit like that. Like it's a new person, new designer kind of thing that they went through it. And you can iterate over it to make things. So I mean, I would toss it out there. If you want to be a designer, you know, two ships battling against each other is just a great format kind of thing, I think, for it. The other thing I would say is when trying to decide, is this a good game or not? One of the metrics that I used to use, and it was kind of for the defense of the wife when I used to buy games, really video games, was the movie rule, right? Could I get a game, play it enough so I could get the value of it like I was going to the movie.
Right.
So if I was paying, you know, $20 or $30 for this game, I'm not sure how much value it is, but if I find it for $10 or $15 and play it for 2 or 3 times with a friend, just to the point that you're saying that there's not other decks, I wonder about the legs of this game.
Gosh, I wish it had other factions.
Yeah, I do too. Because it's an really
easy
fun.
5 if it did for me.
Exactly. But, and I could see, like you're saying, Curio Games or whatever, I could see pulling this down. It's a super fast teach. You could play it 2 or 3 times,
quick
swap
play.
The decks around. Yeah. It was fun. So anyway, I think you guys have covered pretty much everything. I like the fact that there was a lot of good choices, some tactics that you could do. I'm settling on a 4. I thought it was a good value and a fun time to play. Even though I was playing Chris, it was still fun.
But it's a game where all you do is target Chris, and that's like what
true. That's true.
So that should like appeal to you.
That's true.
And then I can't complain about it. Or can I?
Bill, you're ganging up on me.
I'll still find a way to make Bill feel guilty.
True. Come on, Bill. You can target your own sports ships if you want it.
It's my superpower.
And so those are our thoughts.
No.
What's that?
Where are we going to get it?
Oh, where are we going to get it? Hey, Chris, where can we get this?
Yes. So, sadly, there are no copies available on Noble Knight, our sponsor, so you can't get it there. There are only 4 copies on the BGG Marketplace, so this one's pretty rare, pretty obscure. You can pick it up there for a somewhat reasonable price. I think they were in like the $30 range. So, you know, you have to really consider if this is your kind of game, I think. If you really like these two-player head-to-head card dueling games, this is worth a shot. But there aren't many to pick up. So, sorry. I think, honestly, at least I hope, one of the biggest reasons that we do an episode like this is really a lot of our episodes. It's not because you're necessarily going to be able to find them, but maybe you just like to hear about games and hear about designs and what's out there.
Live vicariously through us.
Yeah, that's right. Like, man, I wish I could play these really cool
games. On both
the
good
games.
Side and the bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all that to say, it's a little rare. Sorry about that, but it is findable on BGG. All right.
Now's your moment, Bill.
Oh, wow. And those are our thoughts on Kismet. I don't even know the name.
Conquest at Kismet.
And those are our thoughts on Conquest at Kismet. Wow. Stacked is a family game from 1 to 5 players that is part card game and part dexterity. The goal is to place blocks on top of a preset base to form a teetering tower. Without knocking this tower over, the person to bank the most points in their play pile wins. After much debate on the proper way to play Stacked, the designers decided to include their 3 most popular modes of play. Try them all and enjoy 3 games in 1.
Eh?
That's it.
What'd you say?
Sorry. Was I projecting too
much?
No,
you did great.
Well, thank you.
Hopefully everybody can still hear us. Turn the car volume down.
I can't help it, man. I'm enthusiastic. It's Stacked.
I love it. All right. Stacked. Published in 2020 by Mr. B Games. Okay, so one caveat here. At the time of this recording, it does have a ranking.
Uh-oh.
It did not have a ranking when I bought it.
What are we even doing here?
Okay, wait a minute.
Jason and I are leaving.
I'm serious. This just popped like 3 or 4 weeks ago, okay? It did not have one up to that point. And right now its ranking is 17,784.
Who leaked that we were doing this game and it bumped the ratings high enough to give it a ranking?
Yep, it has creeped on to the ranking list. Our apologies. Designer of this game, 3 designers actually, Sean Brown, who is actually the president of Mr. B Games. He mostly does expansions, so he's done expansions for Defenders of the Realm, Railways of the World, and Age of Steam. Also, a game called Attack, which is a war game. And then the other 2 designers are Leanne Phillips and Tim Phillips, and this is their really only notable design. This game was recommended to us by none other than Dylan St. Clair. This is actually the game that he mentioned to me when he suggested the idea of this episode to begin with. Hmm. All right. Brief rule summary for Stacked. Stacked is a trick-taking dexterity game. Yeah, you heard me right. Mm-hmm. A trick-taking dexterity game where you are trying to win tricks and place Tetris-style pieces on a precarious structure in order to score points. The deck of cards in Stacked consists of 4 different colored suits numbered 1 to 7, with each card represented twice. So in other words, there are 2 red 3s, there are 2 blue 4s, etc., etc. On each card is also pictured a tetromino-style piece, which also has a physical correlate laying on the board. So, for example, the blue 2 and the yellow 2 and the red 2, for that matter, are a long rectangular piece in that given color, whereas the 7 is a T-shaped piece in whatever color the card is. Each card also has a point value associated with it, with the lower numbered cards being worth more points than the higher numbered cards. A game of Stacked begins by creating the base, and this scales by difficulty. So in the basic game, you'll draw 2 random cards off the deck. You'll take those 2 pieces and you'll put them together, and that will be the base upon which you build your structure. However, you can make the game easier or harder by making the base 3 pieces big or a single piece big.
Is that what it means by 3 games in 1?
No. Oh, and I'm glad you mentioned that. There are 2 other games in Stack that we're not reviewing, and the reason why is they're not Trick Taker, and they're almost like children games.
Ah.
We're just reviewing the Trick Taker game for this review. All right. Once the base is created, play begins. The players are all dealt 7 cards, and in each round, the players will secretly choose 1 card to simultaneously reveal for the trick. The lead player will announce the color to be played for that trick. If a player has a card of that color in their hand, they must follow suit and play it. Otherwise, they can choose any other card to play. Once every player has chosen a card, the cards are simultaneously revealed. The player who played the highest card of the called suit wins the trick. Now, starting to the left of the trick winner, each player must, in turn, place the piece pictured on their played card onto the central structure created during the setup. The piece can only be placed with one hand. You can move other pieces around within the structure with your placed piece, but you can't touch any other pieces with your hands. If you are able to successfully add the piece to the structure, the card you played goes into your points pile, and you score the number of points pictured on the card. If you cause the structure to fall, you lose half the points present in your points pile and a new round begins. Players will continue placing in this way until it comes all the way back around to the trick winner. This player will then flip their played card over, scoring 5 points for the card, and then they will force one player at the table to place the piece pictured on their card for them. So it's important to understand that this forced player does not score any points for doing this. And again, the trick winner gets 5 points. So it's the trick winner's enforcing a penalty or it's an uncomfortable situation on a player at the table. If all players successfully place their pieces, the game will continue with the next trick. The players will all draw one card to replace the card they just played. Then the player who played the lowest card to the last trick, regardless of suit. So regardless of what's led, whoever played the lowest card becomes the suit caller for the next trick. Now, a quick word about ties. If two or more players tie for playing the highest card in the called suit, the player who played the next highest card of that suit, if anybody, wins the trick. If two or more players tie for the lowest card played the trick to determine who becomes the caller for the next trick, the previous suit caller remains the suit caller for the next trick. Play continues on this way until one of the players has reached a predetermined number of points for a standard game that's 75, with the player with the highest point total at that time winning the game. That's generally how you play the trick-taking version of Stacked.
Very good.
I feel like we only played to 50.
Was it 50?
Yeah.
Maybe it was 50. 75 is a long game, maybe.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Whatever point total you want to play to.
By the way, the kids' version, Jason, is you just take the cards, flip it over, and whatever shape you see, you put on the stack.
That is correct.
Hmm. So
interesting.
Did you play that?
No, I just read it in the rules.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it didn't sound interesting, mm-hmm. which is why we're not talking about it. All right. Question. So, obviously, I hope it came through in the rules summary. This is a dexterity game, very much so. Kind of in the vein of Jenga, but unlike Jenga, you're not pulling pieces out. You're adding pieces too, but you're interacting with this central structure in the middle of the board that everybody is manipulating in some way. But on top of that, the game is introducing a card play mechanic, trick-taking, mm-hmm. kind of, right? Following suit, but it's simultaneous to reveal. You're not playing in a round. But it's trying to add this card element to it. Mm-hmm. So my question to you would simply be, did you find the trick-taking element interesting to you, and did it add anything to the gameplay? Do you feel like it was a successful marriage of these two mechanisms?
I would say that it definitely made the game better than it would be if it was just the simple version, because that's just reverse Jenga, right? That's sort of like an activity of pure dexterity, who makes the tower fall down. So I think adding in the card play made it interesting in that there was some way to influence what was going on. My trick-taking aficionado side of my brain wishes that there was more depth to the trick-taking in this mm-hmm. game than there actually is. Like, one of the weird things they do is that every time you play a trick, you draw another card into your hand, right? So you're always playing from a hand of 7 cards.
Sure.
So you're never forced to play your hand for what that means in like a normal trick taker. Like, you're forced to play out your whole hand. So you have to figure out, okay, when do I play cards? How do I structure that? There is some of that, but you're also constantly drawing a new card. So there's always the chance of like, well, I just drew the perfect card for the next round, right?
Sure.
Which happens from time to time. So that's a minor complaint. I'm not throwing it out there as like a major con. I think that, I mean what I said, right? Like, it makes it better than it otherwise would have been. I think there could have been more to the trick-taking potentially than what it was.
So okay.
Take that for what you will, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. And the way it played into the stacking, especially when you got to the end game and your tower's getting taller and it's mm-hmm. a lot of the pieces are gone. Because you can look out in the table and see what pieces are gone, and the pieces correlate to a number in your hand. And so one of the things that is super frustrating, and Chris absolutely benefited from this in the games that we played, But when two people play the same number, right, they get canceled out, whether it's the bottom one or the top one. And so there is a little bit of a strategy in there about, like, when do you hold your sevens, which are the highest number in there, and when do you hold your lowest ones for things so that you can take control.
Because if you hold that seven and somebody else plays the other seven in that color, at that point, you know you have a winner in your hand.
Exactly.
Which is an important strategy in this game. I'm not disagreeing with you, Jason. This is not a deep trick taker, but there are definitely things to think about in that understanding when you have a winner and what to do with it. Okay. Right. And specifically, I guess what I would mean is I think this game really changed for me. I had a pretty miserable first play of this game. Bill, I think you were in that game. Maybe your first couple of plays, actually, if I'm remembering correctly. Because I was treating it very much just like a dexterity game. Mm-hmm. And I think we all were. You know, we were just building the structure as high as we could make it. And we were trying to fit everything on there and just trying not to make it fall. Mm-hmm. And I was usually the one making it fall because I don't consider myself to be a great dexterity game player. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like things began to change for me and how I viewed the game when I began to realize that I needed to play my cards a little more smartly.
Right.
And I guess what I mean by that is I started to figure out, well, if I get a lot of low cards where I know I can grab the lead and I know I have winners, what would happen if I intentionally destabilized the structure by placing stupidly, but not making it fall and then calling for a suit that I know that I can win? And now I'm forcing my opponents to place blocks on a precarious structure.
Yep.
And I found that to be fun. Mm-hmm. Timing when the right time to do that was. Because you don't want to do it too early. Because if you go too soon and they get it on there, then you kind of missed your opportunity. Mm-hmm. But if you wait too late, you might end up making it fall, right? So you're trying to decide, okay, when am I going to try to grab control here and win a trick and make them make it fall so I don't make it fall, right?
Right.
It does make an interesting tension between the high cards and low cards, right? Because you can take the high card strategy of like, well, I'm just going to keep winning tricks and forcing other people to play for me. But you can also take the, I'm just going to hold a lot of low cards strategy where I'm going to keep the lead.
Right.
But I'm just going to use my low card plays where I still have to place a block because I'm not winning the trick. But I'm going to place the blocks in ridiculous ways that make it really difficult. Now, the backfire to that plan is that if people sense that you're doing that, then the person who won the trick is going to stick you with placing the big block.
Right. Right.
But it also incentivizes the point value of the low cards is the highest.
Right.
Aside from like winning a trick. If you win a trick, you flip it over, you get 5 points, which is definitely the highest. But the one is worth 3 points, whereas the seven, if you just play it for what it is, I mean, you would never play it and not win the trick, I guess, unless you tied.
Yeah, you would, unless you tie.
Yeah, if you tied.
And you only get 1 point.
You only get 1 point.
And then you have to place it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so playing a lot of low cards and keeping the lead but losing tricks, you're still scoring 3 points every time.
Right.
So there was a good tension in that. I agree.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I did like how this game also had a little bit of a push your luck element to it.
Right.
Because you can see what pieces haven't been placed yet. So you see what cards could beat you. Mm-hmm. And based how people are playing, or maybe how people aren't following suit, and you're like, oh, okay, well, Bill doesn't have red. Mm-hmm. Maybe Jason doesn't have, maybe I play the five red. Maybe that will win, right? And I can get 5 points. But the thing about that is if it doesn't win, it's worth less points than playing a low-numbered card, and it's more dangerous to place on the structure. Mm-hmm. So you're really trying to decide, when do I play a low card? When do I play a middling card? When do I play a high card? Again, I'm not saying it's the deepest trick taker ever, but I did find the more I thought about it, the more I started to see these little things that there were to think about, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was funny because, like you, my progression of understanding the game, I played it just like a dexterity game, like you did at first. Mm-hmm. Not paying that much attention, but I was winning a fair amount of the tricks because I was just playing my high card for the most part.
Right, right.
And I was still pulling them in. When I started trying to quote-unquote strategize, I was holding my higher cards to later, but there was a couple rounds where it fell way more early than I thought it was gonna fall, and so I didn't have many win tricks in my pile, so I didn't have many points for that round. So it becomes an interesting balance, like you're saying, not only push your luck on the stack, but also on when do you get rid of your big cards.
Yep.
So
I found from time to time, too, that I would also sometimes be looking at my cards and being like, okay, based on the way the structure looks right now, regardless of trick-taking strategy, is there a particular card I should play because the piece that I'm going to place actually fits better in the structure than the alternative, right? And I think that's a cool blend of the dexterity versus trick-taking elements, too.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're kind of bringing it back to dexterity because I don't want to throw this part away. I think the trick-taking is the most interesting, but I think we all picked up on this, and I think it's worth mentioning, going back to the dexterity element. These pieces, while they are tetromino, there are a couple of them that the lengths on some of the sides are not the same length.
Yeah, they're not. If a tetromino piece is made of cubes put together to make shapes, these are not cubes.
They're not like, all of them.
No, all of them. The thickness of the pieces is not the same as the width.
Okay.
Right? So, I don't know how to explain this. If you took like a Tetris L shape and you look at it sideways, it looks like an L. All the blocks are cubes. But if you put it on its side, it is flatter than a cube.
Right.
So, and all the pieces are that way. So if you put them on their side in certain ways, the structure does not fit together perfectly like a cube-built structure, which actually makes it more interesting because it means that you can mess with the balance of it more.
And we created some crazy... I swear sometimes it looked like it was like flaring outwards. And I'm like, how is this thing not falling down? You know what I mean? It just lended itself to that, which I found to be amusing. Not to mention being able to use your piece to push pieces around, which is dangerous. But you can push things around to then enable yourself to place your piece more safely if you don't knock it down by doing that. Again, I found that entertaining just watching other people do that, including myself. I don't know. I just thought that was fun.
What I found entertaining was watching Chris and myself do it and then watch Cameron do it with his rock steady surgeon hands.
He's so steady.
Chris and I just shaking as we go in. So,
I have this weird thing where I get it like a millimeter away from touching and then I violently move it towards it. And I don't know why I do that. It's just a weird thing that I do.
Right.
Having flashbacks to the ship game.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I'll drop it from like a quarter inch away. I'll get there and then I'll drop it on it. It's like, oh my God.
Now, so to that point, I think there is an element to this game in which, like, you, that aspect of control is a little out of your hands. Because normally in a game where it's dexterity based, the person who makes it fall is the primary person who's impacted. Whereas in this game, even though it's the person who makes it fall who loses the points, you can still kind of end up getting screwed over if the structure falls before you were ready for it to fall.
Yeah, right. If you were setting yourself up for something. Right.
You have a bunch of high cards that you could take some tricks. Yeah.
And I would also mention, I'm sure we were all thinking this too. I'll go ahead and get it to us. We had it happen a couple times where it just fell.
Yeah.
Now, whether that happened because Ken bumped his elbow on the table or something else happened, I don't know if we'll ever know. But we did have a couple times where nobody was placing anything and it just went down.
Yep.
And that was a little bit unsatisfying figuring out how to resolve that because it was like, ugh, dang it. You know, that can happen in this game.
Right.
All right. Any other thoughts before we move on?
I don't think so.
No.
All right. Kick us off, Chris.
Okay. So as I mentioned in the review, when I first played this game, I did not like it at all. It actually made me kind of annoyed because... like I said, I don't consider myself very steady-handed. I don't really love dexterity games to begin with. I didn't review Riff Raff very favorably when we went over it. It's just not my genre, you know what I mean? But as I mentioned in the review, the game really became much more fun for me when I started to figure out I don't have to try to put these on here perfectly and make this thing sky high and then ultimately be the one that knocks it down and everybody else scores 50 points and I got 20, you know what I mean? It got really fun to start monkeying with it kind of early if I felt like my hand lended itself to that, right? Mm-hmm. And figuring out how to play around with it and not be the one to make it fall because of how I was playing my cards.
Right.
Right. And so when that light bulb went on for me, I had a lot more fun with this game and I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I'm not saying that this is the deepest trick taker of all time by any means. It's really not. But I do... say, and I do believe that there is some clever play here. I think there is some control here. Sure, there's a little bit of luck that goes on with the ties and such, but it wasn't enough to bother me. I just found this game to be hilarious once we got to that point, and I really enjoyed it. I'm giving this game 5.
Oh, wow.
I liked this game a lot. I'm glad I have it. I'm actually kind of excited to try this with my family or with my extended family, like my aunts and uncles and things, because they play card games.
Yeah.
I could see this doing really well in that setting.
Right.
Because they understand trick takers, of which this is a simple one. And then it's Jenga, right? Mm-hmm. Reverse Jenga, I guess, with card play. I mean, I just think this is fun. I'm glad I have it. I think it was enjoyable. Excellent, in my opinion. Way better than 17,000 on BGG. So, yeah, I'm going to give it a 5.
Cool. Well, I guess it's me. So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it as well. And I liked the fact that you could, in a whole round, not put a piece down. And so you could actually absolutely plan out that I'm going to jink with the structure the turn before, know pretty well that you're not going to be one of the people adding the structure and then come away with a win. It would be an awesome drinking game, right? I mean, if you're in college, I mean, it would be
see people playing this in like a brewery or something.
Right. It's a kind of a mini party game for five people kind of thing. I don't have much more to add than what you just said. I gave it a 4. I think it'd be a good beach game.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I won't belabor this. I gave it a 4 too. I enjoy dexterity games, aside from Riff Raff. That was too finicky, but I enjoy the stacking. I think I have the steady hands, too, for this type of thing. And I liked the card element, despite my wishing there was more there. There is some strategy to it. I think it makes what would be kind of just a ho-hum, boring, let's stack the blocks and see who makes it fall type game into something more than that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I enjoyed it enough that if it came out again, I would want to play it some more. Am I over the moon about it? No, but I give it a 4.
Nice.
Cool.
4-4-5.
4-4-5.
How about that?
It's funny. This is a family game that I have.
I saw you blame that. What is that?
Like from the 1970s blockhead. But not a card game, but the only thing is it starts with this piece. You put blockhead down, you put a block on the block, and the only rule is you just put one of these crazy blocks on it and you go around the circle. So
that's it.
So that's the game. So
yeah.
It's nice to see it evolve into something a little bit more than...
More going on. I wonder if that's got a BGG entry. I'm going to look it up after this episode. Blockhead.
Blockhead. Then you can try to do this here in the front.
Love it. Yeah, well, if this sounded interesting to you, and I hope that it did, I do have some good news here. There are copies of this on Noble Knight.
Oh, wow.
As it turns out. Like, so this game is not that old. 2020. It just totally didn't land. It just felt... I mean, Mr. B Games, to be fair, nothing against them, but their games, for whatever reason, don't tend to get a lot of traction. I don't know why. And this one is no exception. But like I said, it's not that old, so you can find it. If you do decide to purchase it through Noble Knight, I would ask that you please use our discount code. That is HIDDEN23. If you do that, support Noble Knight, you'll get 10% off your order. We would really appreciate that. There are also 2 copies on BGG Marketplace. Not many there, but interestingly, you can also get this game on Amazon and eBay. I'm only mentioning that because it's a little harder to find, but we would really appreciate it if you use Noble Knight if you think about picking it up. But you can get it there as well. So it's available.
To answer your question, Bill, Blockhead is on BGG.
Yeah.
It was released in 1952.
Wow.
It has a 5.4 rating. It's ranked 22,821. Oh, that
could be it has a ranking.
It does.
However, it was re-implemented by Super Blockhead in 1992, which does not have a rating. So
of the one that's ranked, the first one, how many ratings does it have?
292.
No way. Yeah. So this is a game people... played when they were kids, like you, right? Yes, Bill, in the 50s?
It doesn't look like your copy.
I was not alive in the 50s. We'll say that. Does it look like that?
It looks like it's had many printings.
Okay.
With different boxes. But the game itself is the same.
Blockhead. All right. Well, that was fun.
It was fun.
Yeah. I don't know how we feel about doing this again, but I'm just going to point out, this is just me, all of these games I gave a 4 or higher to. And that was not me... That was me being totally honest. I honestly enjoyed every single one of these games. And they're either unranked or very, very far down, 17,000. I thought it was just an interesting experiment, at least.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
I can probably find some more. I'll have to go back to my BGG mining.
You got to mine some more.
Yeah. If you haven't listened to our podcast for a long time, you will have no idea what I'm talking about because we haven't talked about it in a very long time. But... at one point early on in the show, our goal was to peruse all of BGG and mine it for as many hidden gems as we could find. And I did. I made it pretty far.
You did.
Through the list. And then I got sidetracked with, you know, life. I still have the spreadsheet. I'll go back
to it.
We'll
get back to it.
I'll find you some.
We got such a huge backlog right now. People ask me that know us that don't know a whole lot about games, just kind of tangentially, you know. And they're like, are you ever going to run out? And I'm like, never, never.
Right.
We could do this until we're 80 and we would still have games.
Right. A small
yeah, batch. I only made it through like a quarter of BGG's thing and I had like over 1,200 games
yeah.
flagged.
Yeah. It's crazy. All right. Those are our thoughts on Stacked.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Hidden Gems. If you're enjoying what we're doing on the podcast, and we hope that you are, please remember that it's a huge help to us when folks like yourselves give us a rating or review on the various podcast platforms out there, or when you follow us on social media. If you're so inclined, please consider supporting the show over on our Patreon at patreon.com/hiddengemspodcast. Check out our Discord channel or the BGG Guild if you'd like to interact with us or share a game that you feel is a hidden gem. Until next time, I'm your host, Jason.
It's Chris.
And I'm Bill.
Thanks for listening.
This episode of Hidden Gems, number 51, was recorded in Raleigh, North Carolina on June 29, 2023. Be sure to join us next time as we do a joint review with one of our top-tier Patreon gem miners and cover three games with a Roman theme. Hidden Gems is produced and edited by Chris Alley, Cameron Lockie, and Jason Yonchilev. Our Board Game Geek Guild is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Ghidorah. Our Discord channel is monitored and managed by honorary Hidden Gems team member Snoozefest. Our show's logo was illustrated by designer and artist Caitlin Nieto. Check out her work on Instagram at It's Caitlin Nieto. We would love to hear from you. Feel free to join the discussion on our many social media accounts. You can find us on Facebook at Hidden Gems Board Game Podcast, Instagram at HiddenGems.podcast, and Twitter at Hidden Gems Board. Disagree with one of our reviews? Have something you want to say about one of the games we discussed today? You can also make your voice heard on our Board Game Geek Guild at BoardGameGeek.com, guild number 3874. Once again, thank you for joining us on Hidden Gems, and until next time, fellow gem seekers, enjoy your games and enjoy your search.